Chapter 32. There are certain rules to a successful deception, of which my personal favourite is, stick with what you know. That is not to say that truth should ever be incorporated into your lies, but rather that good research is the key to a consistent lie. It was, in 1956, by no means impossible for a citizen of the West to enter the East, far easier, in fact, than for a citizen of the East to head to the West. But to declare yourself as such was to invite immediate attention and scrutiny, and this was, I felt, something I could not necessarily afford. I had, in my 12th life, after receiving Krista's message, embarked on what I believe would come to be known in the 1990s as a portfolio existence. I travelled extensively under the flimsy cover of executive businessman, and dabbled with whichever intelligence services I felt might be of most use to me in order to keep as broad an eye as possible on global events. In 1929, aged 11, I bought up stocks as the markets collapsed, and by 1933 I was the sole shareholder in one of the fastest-growing investment brokerages in the Northern Hemisphere. An actor by the name of Cyril Handley was paid a very reasonable wage to impersonate me, it being unwise for a 15-year-old boy to be caught as CEO of a large investment company. He was precisely what a chairman should have been: dignified, well-built, with a carefully cultivated accent, refined tastes, and a reasonable but not unhealthy belly on him, and his combination of judicious silence and fiery retribution worked well in the office until, in 1936, his enjoyment of the role became a little too much to tolerate when he began sacking reliable members of staff during board meetings. I relocated the company to Switzerland, paid Cyril off with a retirement home in Bali, and employed a rather young actor to impersonate my son, newly risen to become head of the company, buying his complicity with a mixture of reasonable fees and, in a twist that surprised me more than anyone else, regular lessons in economics, finance and accountancy, which led to, by 1938, my having complete confidence in his ability to run the company with the barest interference from me. Invest in American arms, steel, chemicals and petrol was the only guidance I gave him in 1938, as the world slid towards war. Pull out of the Skoda arms factory and withdraw all foreign personnel from Singapore. By 1948, Waterbrook and Smith, two names chosen for no reason other than their entire lack of connection to myself, was one of the most successful companies in the Northern Hemisphere, with extensive and occasionally illegal contacts in Southeast Asia and Africa, and growing interests in Chile, Venezuela, and, in a move which I quietly had to question, Cuba. The company was successful, unethical, and above all, provided me with a continual influx of both ready cash, a mild interest, and global information without my ever having to show my face. It was one report, a tiny note in the 100 that arrived at my door every week, which sent me to Russia. The title of the document read, "Limited exposure to PJC 9000, portable radio, commercial." In it, an analyst briefly discussed the company's recent investment in a radio transmitter receiver set which had gone on the market in West Germany some 2 months before, whose range and quality of signal had been recognised and rewarded in the last week by a contract with the Air Force to fit out its stations with the new equipment. Technical specs were attached, and flicking through them, I saw nothing remarkable, until my eye, wandering down the page, glimpsed the operational frequency of the transmitter. It was some 200,000 hertz outside the normal range of the equipment of the time, and while this relatively low number in terms of radio frequencies might not have set off many alarm bells, the mechanism by which it appeared to achieve this effect was something which should not have been invented, let alone been available on commercial markets, for another 13 years.